Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Ocean Robbins, author of 31-Day Food Revolution and founder and CEO of the 500,000-plus member Revolution Network. And I'll tell you more about him in just a little bit when he comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news and, of course, my weekly recipe with all of you. So first in the news, very exciting, last week, Governor Cuomo here in New York signed executed the nation's largest offshore wind agreement, and he also signed the Historic Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And this is a act that we've been trying to push through for years now. It used to be called the Climate and Community Protection Act, and added leadership in there now. But it's a great, great new goal to work towards clean energy and equality and equity in our food system and in our environment. And it's really going to set New York on the right path towards getting off of fossil fuels and leading us towards a more renewable way of living. And the offshore wind agreement is really exciting. It's going to be the nation's largest offshore wind project. It's supposed to generate 1,700 megawatts, which is enough energy to power over 1 million homes. And it's really exciting. And it's, you know, we're trying to get to a carbon-free New York by 2040, and this should really help us do that. It should give us an 85% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And, you know, 2050 seems like it's far off, but we know how time flies. So it will be here before we know it. And global warming is here. We need to really take drastic actions, and this is at least a start. So I'm really, really so thrilled. I know I've been signing petitions for years to try to push these forward, and I'm really, really excited that that's happening. Also, I know many of my listeners know that I am the farm-to-school coordinator now at a local public school, Glen Cove Public School, and I'm really in support of getting more fresh vegetables into the school lunch program. And I'm asking everyone to support the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act, which is coming up again for a new draft. And this is the piece of legislation that actually decides what gets fed to our school kids. And right now, the school lunch program is really quite sad, even though it had some improvements when Michelle Obama was the first lady. But, you know, even though we took one step forward, as you know, we then took two steps back. And this just seems to be the way we work. So the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act really needs your support, and I will have that a link to that on my website for you to sign, the Farm to School Act of 2019 and the Kids Eat Local Act. Both of these are blueprints for supporting farm to school programs in the next Reauthorization Act. So please, I ask all of you to sign that. And if you got to listen to my guest from last week, Dr. David Waldingo, we talked a lot about the global problem of antibiotic resistance, and I put a lot of links up there as well. We need to all just take a stand and start getting involved. We all tend to talk about this, but really not really do anything, and we all need to participate more in taking a stand and becoming activists, because that is what got the Netherlands and Denmark to stop using so many antibiotics in their farm-produced meat. Of course, you know, eating less farm-raised meat is a really great thing. Eating none at all is even better. But since that's not happening, what we can do at least is try to get the conditions better for the animals and certainly get the antibiotics out of the meat so that we don't have this global problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So please, everybody, become activists. And now I'd like to share with you this week's recipe, which is really simple. I mean, it's been so hot that all I wanted to eat was fresh fruit and salads. So this is a fresh fruit salad with a vanilla cream sauce that I made. It's, you know, vegan and gluten-free. I made the vanilla cream out of soaked cashews. So this is the recipe. Feel free to adjust any of the fresh fruit that you want, you know, whatever you have in the house. I called for a cup of strawberries, but when I looked at my refrigerator, I was down to four. Someone got in there before me, so I only had four strawberries in my fruit salad. But whatever you have, just cut it up. So I started with 4 cups of watermelon that I cut into 1-inch cubes, 2 cups of blueberries, 1 cup of raspberries. I'm telling you, a cup of strawberries, even though I didn't really have that. 1 mango that I cut into cubes. And then for the sauce, I soaked 1 cup of cashews for 3 to 5 hours. The longer you soak them, the less water you need to add to the sauce. So I soaked them for about 5 hours, and then I drained it. I put those cashews into the blender, and I added 1/4 cup of tahini, 3 tablespoons of maple syrup, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1 cup of water, and juice of 1 lemon. And then I just pulsed that and blended that up till it was really, really creamy and smooth. And it was delicious. If you like it a little sweeter, you could add another tablespoon of maple syrup, but I didn't want mine too sweet. Then I also chopped up some mint, and I added mint to that, and I saved a couple whole mint leaves for garnish on the side of the dish. And so it was really beautiful looking. I recommend not mixing the whole fruit salad with the sauce, but more using the sauce as a drizzle on top. It just looks prettier that way. But it, you know, came together so quickly. It was really easy, and it was the perfect lunch for a hot, steamy day. So please enjoy that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Ocean Robbins. He is the CEO and co-founder of the 500,000-plus member Food Revolution Network, which is one of the largest communities of healthy eating advocates on the planet. He's held hundreds of live seminars and events that have touched millions of lives in over 190 nations. Ocean is founder and was director of the nonprofit YES, which has led transformational events for 650,000 leaders in 65 nations. He's a recipient of the National Jefferson Award for Outstanding Public Service, the Freedom's Flame Award, the Harmon Wilkinson Award, and numerous other honors. Ocean has served as adjunct professor for Chapman University and on the boards of Friends of the Earth, Creating Our Future, Tipping Point Network, Turning Tide Coalition, and many other organizations. Ocean's grandfather was the founder of Baskin Robbins, and his father, John Robbins, walked away from the family company and ice cream fortune to write his bestseller, Diet for a New America, and to become a renowned health advocate. And now Ocean is on a mission to do the same and to transform the industrialized food culture into one that celebrates and supports healthy people and a healthy planet. And I'm so happy to have him on with us today. I met him this spring at the Real Truth About Health conference that took place in Melville, Long Island, and he just really stood out as just being such a wonderful advocate for healthy eating in a non-judgmental and really compassionate way. So, Ocean, welcome.
Well, I'm thrilled to be with you. Thank you so much.
Sure. So, I thought maybe we could just start a little bit talking about your wonderful, unique family history. I mean, your grandfather founded an ice cream legend, Baskin Robbins, and your dad, you know, left that and went on to write his book. So, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, my dad, John, grew up with an ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in the backyard and 31 flavors of ice cream in the freezer. He was groomed from early childhood to one day join in running the family company. But when he was in his early 20s, he was offered that chance, and he said no, and he walked away from a path that was practically paved with gold and ice cream to, as we jokingly say in our family, follow his own rocky road. he ended up moving with my mom to a little island off the coast of Canada where they built a one-room log cabin and grew most of their own food. They practiced yoga and meditation for several hours a day, and they named their kid Ocean. Now, apparently, they almost named me Kale. And I've got to tell you, I am glad for the sake of my social life that they took the more conservative route when they named their son. But we did eat a lot of kale and cabbage and carrots and beets and other veggies from the garden. And in time, my dad ended up researching the food industry in which he had grown up and coming out with the book Diet for a New America in 1987. It became a runaway bestseller, and it inspired millions of people to look at food as a chance to make a difference in the world. He inspired a lot of folks to rethink their food choices, and the media called him the rebel without a cone. In time, one of his readers, amazingly enough, was my grandpa, Irvin Robbins. Now, my dad's uncle, Bert Baskin, my grandpa's brother-in-law and business partner, had died of heart disease at the age of 54. And my grandpa, in his early 70s, was facing the standard American diseases of heart disease and diabetes and serious obesity issues. His doctors told him he didn't have long to live unless he made some big changes. And then his doctors gave him a copy of my dad's book, which my grandpa read. He followed its advice, and he made some big changes. He gave up sugar. He gave up most of the processed foods. He cut way down on his meat consumption. He gave up ice cream, and he ended up eating a whole lot more vegetables and whole plant foods, and he got results. The kind of results that we predictably see when people make changes like this. He ended up losing 30 pounds, reversing his diabetes and heart disease, and his golf game improved 7 strokes. So we've seen in our family that when we eat the standard American diet, we get the standard American diseases, and we've also seen what can happen when we make a change. And I'm so grateful that my grandpa had the courage to make those changes. I'm so grateful that my dad chose conscience over a life of immense wealth so that he could stand for something and help millions of people be healthier. And I'm grateful that I get to work with him because now I direct Food Revolution Network, working closely with my dad. And we are standing for healthy, ethical, sustainable food for all. We have over 500,000 members. And our goal is to empower everybody with life saving, health-boosting, world-changing knowledge so that we can all be part of the solution.
So cool. So cool. Just out of curiosity, did your grandfather, after he saw those changes, did he do anything to try to make the ice cream that he was serving any healthier?
He had moved on. He sold the company. When my dad said no to joining him, he sold it, and he was done. He had no part in it. So we have, you know, and Baskin Robbins has been sold multiple times since then. So despite the fact that it carries our family name, it's not something that we're linked to in any way whatsoever. But I think that, you know, my grandpa still had a lot of investment in the belief that there was no connection between food and health. And that's what he thought for most of his life. And then he experienced something very different. And, you know, he said on his deathbed when he was in his 90s, after having a good, long, healthy life, he said to my dad, you know, when you left Baskin Robbins, I'll be honest, I thought you were crazy. And he said, and I might have been right, but thank God some of us have learned a few new things in the course of our lives. And he said, what? You were right. And I'm so glad.
You're never too old to learn, right?
That's right.
To make change. So you and your dad, you call your organization Food Revolution Network. You want to talk a little bit what you mean by a food revolution?
Well, we live in a society where it's considered normal to eat food that is full of added sugars, hormones, antibiotics, chemicals, pesticides, flavorings, preservatives, additives, GMOs. And we've basically got a toxic soup. Our bodies were not designed for the food that we're giving them today. And as a result, we have an epidemic of chronic illness. You know, young people born today are the first generation in history to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents in the history of the United States. We have an epidemic of chronic illness that is bankrupting us. 19% of our gross domestic product goes to what we call health care. But the reality is, if we're really honest about it, we're not caring for health. We're treating the symptoms of disease. because prevention is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we're focusing entirely on what happens after people get sick, not on how to keep people healthy in the first place. And it all starts with food. The Global Burden of Disease is a report published by the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation every year. Researchers at the University of Washington, dozens of researchers, study the major causes of disease and disability all over the world. And they have concluded that the modern diet is the driving force behind 672,000 deaths every year in the United States alone. This means more.
Can you
Americans
say that
are
number
dying.
Again?
672,000. More Americans are dying every year than died in all of World War I, World War II, Vietnam War, both Iraq Wars, Afghanistan War, Korean War combined. But this time the enemy isn't another country or guns and bombs. It's our own knives and forks and what we're doing with them. So when we call for a food revolution, we're saying, look, folks, we need to treat this with the same seriousness that we would treat a war, because our people are dying right now. But the good news is that in this revolution, everybody wins. Your health wins. Your planet wins. We can build a healthier future for life just by making the right choices. And so we don't fight this with guns and bombs. We fight it with our knives and forks, and with our consciousness, and with learning and growing, and quite frankly, with loving ourselves more by treating our bodies with the care and the respect that they deserve.
Mm. Absolutely. I'm with you on that. You know, part of our problem is the profit that the food industry makes and the pharmaceutical company makes and the biotech companies make. They all are all making so much profit on putting out this sick food. And our politicians get paid off by them. And so, you know, it's really hard to put in place the kind of laws or guidelines that need to happen to really, you know, change the food that's out there.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your 31-day food revolution and, you know, what's part. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the diet and what you recommend in the book?
Well, there's four principles to the food revolution program, and I wrote 31-day food revolution to help bring these out widely to the world. Number one is eat less sugar and processed junk. Number two is eat less animal products, especially from factory farms. Number three is eat more whole plant foods. And number four is conscious sourcing, which basically means that it matters how your food was grown and where it comes from, as well as what it is. Food that's grown on nutrient-depleted soils with pesticides and hormones from genetically engineered seeds is not going to give you the same nutrition, the same life value that food that's grown on rich organic soil, you know, with compost and healthy fertilizers is going to bring you. Food that's grown locally that was picked yesterday is going to be healthier and more vibrant than food that's traveled thousands of miles and was picked green a month ago. And so I'm saying that all of these things matter. And it's not just my opinion. This is based on over 10,000 studies published in peer-reviewed medical journals, which tell us conclusively and definitively that when we eat more whole plant foods, when we eat more high-nutrient foods, we do our bodies a great favor and we extend our lifespan dramatically. You know, I look at the blue zones. These are the places that Dan Buettner documented for National Geographic where people in the world live the longest, healthiest lives. Okinawa, Japan, Sardinia in Italy, Icarus in Greece, Loma Linda, California, the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica. And in all of these places, people have certain things in common. They have exercise built into the fabric of their lives, they have strong social ties, and they have basically clean environments around them with good clean water, and they eat healthy plant-based food. In the blue zones, people get between 0 and 10% of their calories from animal products. In the United States, we're at more like 34%. In the blue zones, they get virtually none of their calories from sugar or processed junk. In the United States, we're at like 70%. So when we cut out the animal products and the sugar and the processed junk and we eat whole plant foods, we live more like the Blue Zones, and they outlive us dramatically. In Loma Linda, California, the people in that Blue Zone have a life expectancy 9 years beyond the national average in America today. 9 years. And they eat a predominantly whole foods, plant-based diet. So we can learn a lot from these people.
And that's 9 healthy
and
years.
From all the studies.
Right? And we can put it into living longer if you're going to be tied to machines and sick. The idea is to live longer.
Exactly. And that's the wonderful thing in the Blue Zones. People tend to be vibrantly healthy until the end. Yeah, because we have more and more people who are living chronically ill. You know, my great-grandmother lived to be over 100. But for the last 20 years, she was blind and deaf. And I can't wish her last 20 years on anybody, honestly. I don't think any of us really want to live like that. That's not life. That's survival. But
exactly.
To really
live that quite a bit
point.
Too.
And so we don't just add years to life. We add life to years.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to eat more healthfully but struggle with implementing this, do you have any suggestions, either just right now or in your book, that you give to people to help them make that transition to a healthier lifestyle?
Absolutely. Well, any journey starts where you are, and you need to have a vision of where you want to go, and then you take steps to bridge the gap. And so 31-Day Food Revolution has 31 chapters, and each chapter ends with simple action steps you can take to apply what you've just learned. And there are actually 3 levels of action steps in each case, because depending on whether you're kind of a newcomer on the journey or you're more advanced, the next step might be different. So for some people, we say eat more vegetables, and it's a big step if they can, you know, steam a pot of greens and eat at least a mouthful of it. You know, for other people, they want to get to their 6 cups a day of greens, you know, eat kale for breakfast. You know, some people are, you know, trying to get off of the, you know, fast food restaurants, and other people are looking at how they can, you know, cook more meals at home. And so wherever you are in the journey, there are steps you can take. But I would say look at the worst offenders. Look at the things you're eating in your life right now that are the least healthy, that you know you want to shift, and look at where you slip and fall down, and then build habits and grooves and patterns that help you do better in those spots. You know, a chain is as strong as its weakest link. So make your weakest link stronger, and everything else gets stronger. And the thing to remember is the best time to repair a roof is when the sun is shining, and the best time to build a healthier habit is when you have time and space to do so. So it's not the end of an exhausting long day when you are prone to late-night cookie binges or opening up bags of potato chips and then finding yourself on the wrong side of an empty one. The time to make a change, really, is when you have space to clear out your cupboards, to shop for healthy snacks or healthy foods, and get rid of the bad stuff so you're not tempted. And that way, when you're up late at night and you're stressed and you're going through a tough time emotionally, you comfort yourself with foods that are comforting to your long-term wellness instead of mortgaging your health and your happiness for a short-term fix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk a lot with people about having a healthy pantry, like having things in your cupboards and in your fridge that you can put together easily, because, you know, so many of us are busy and we don't have time to come home and do a whole big, you know, hours of cooking. But there's a lot of things that you can have, you know, that are, that cook up quicker. And, you know, with quinoa's, you know, a great example. It's, you know, a grain, or not really a grain, a seed. But, you know, that cooks up much quicker than, let's say, brown rice, which is 40 minutes. Or, you know, I talk to people, when you cook brown rice, make a double batch and freeze one half of it so that you can pull it out of the freezer if you need to put together dinner quickly. You know, there's so many little tips you can do to make it more realistic to eat in a healthy way. Do you have some of those tips in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots and lots of them, as well as recipes. You know, at the end of the day, most people don't just struggle with knowing what to do, but also with doing what we know. And I'm not interested in more education, more people feeling like, oh my gosh, I need to change more things. And then eventually it feels like a guilt-inducing thing. You know, I'm interested in empowerment and action, because at the end of the day, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, they don't care a heck of a lot how much you know, how many books you read, how many radio shows you listen to. They care what you eat and how you live, what your actual choices are day in and day out. And so 31-Day Food Revolution is about helping you make the healthy choices that empower your life. And that's what my work is all about as well. I'm interested in results. I'm interested in impact, not just wisdom, but life-giving wisdom we can apply. And so that's why there's all the action steps. That's why there's recipes. And I really want to help people solve problems. You know, the biggest problems people face in healthy eating are time, financial resources, bad habits, and social pressures. And so we look at each of these things. And, you know, for example, with time, you can plan ahead. You can shop less often and shop from a list. You can cook in large quantities and then freeze leftovers or extras. Make friends with leftovers. Never cook just one meal at a time. When you're going to make something, make a lot of it, and then you can have it for lunch the next day and dinner the day after that. Share some with friends and neighbors. Build social connection. Get food swaps going. I'll make you dinner on Monday. You make me dinner on Tuesday. Let's share and bring the community back into our food lives.
There's so much more of that. I mean, there's apps for sharing these days, and it's so necessary because I think so many people live in their little bubble, and there's a lot less social connections happening than there used to be, and food is just such a great way of bringing people back together.
It really is. Throughout history, breaking bread together, sharing meals together has been a source of connection between people, and we need to bring back the community into our food lives so that it builds bonds of connection and trust and, frankly, love. Loneliness kills faster than cigarettes. And so I'm interested in how food can be a source of connection. Healthy food can be a source of connection between human beings. Food has been co-opted and commercialized and turned into a source of short-term pleasure and high-volume monetary profit for a few. But I want to make it a source of connection and love, nourishment, and vitality, something that feeds us and feeds our souls and feeds the future we want for future generations.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you talk about in your book is eating humanely. Can you talk a little bit what you mean by that?
While I was researching 31-Day Food Revolution, I got to spend some time with a chicken farmer by the name of Craig Watts. Craig ran an operation in North Carolina with 20,000 birds, and he had inherited the land. He put a big farm on there. He was working with Purdue, and he followed their advice precisely, and he bought the feed from them, put up all the apparatus per their instructions. And in his contract with Purdue, he was forbidden from ever opening the windows because that would stimulate the chickens to move more, which would be bad for the feed conversion ratio. He was forbidden from giving them any natural light for the same reason. And the birds had an average of, less than a square foot per bird. A bird has a natural wingspan when they're full grown of 3 feet. And they didn't even have a foot, less than the screen of a laptop computer per chicken. And they are in these extremely hostile conditions where the birds were literally, they were bred to be morbidly obese. So the equivalent to if a human infant, by the time they're 3 months old, weighed 600 pounds. So they couldn't walk once they got to be a few weeks old. And they would sit in their own feces. And the feces of previous generations. The barn was cleaned every few years. And so they're lying in poop. They have sores developed. They lose feathers. And 5% of them were dead before they were killed because they died in the warehouse. So he didn't like having to treat birds like this, but it was standard operating procedure, and he had to make a living. And then one day, he sees an ad. Jim Perdue is on TV. And Jim Perdue was saying, you know, we take good care of our birds, and they're happy and they're healthy. And Craig said, you know, I might be a cruel chicken farmer, but I'm no liar. I'm not a psychologist, but I can tell you these birds aren't happy. I'm not a vet, but I can tell you they're not healthy. And if I don't do something, then I'm a liar, and that's not me. So he ended up inviting Compassion in World Farming, which is a nonprofit animal advocacy organization, to come on in and bring cameras and film his award-winning Purdue-certified chicken operation to show them what really happens behind the scenes. And this wasn't some undercover animal rights group sneaking in. This was the doors being thrown open. And the video went viral, and people all over the world watched it. And Purdue was mad. And they tried to punish him, and he ended up getting rid of his chicken farm. And now he's growing food crops. And he has become an advocate in the last couple of years. He now helps factory farmers transition to make healthier choices and move towards organic and move away from animal products altogether and do so in an economically viable way. And Craig's a hero to me. But the experience of his story also opens a lot of eyes to what's really going on, because what he was doing was normal. We have created a situation in which animals are systematically treated with enormous cruelty in our factory farming system. If you or I were to treat a dog or a cat the way that is standard of practice in the animal products industry, we would go to jail.
Right.
But in every law in the United States, there are laws against animal cruelty, but they specifically exempt animals raised for food. And this is why the normal has become so dreadfully cruel. And the reality is that when we treat animals this way, when we deprive them of all of their basic biological instincts being expressed, when we feed them dreadful diets that are nothing like what they were designed for by nature, when then we create the conditions for tremendous disease. So then these animals are pumped full of antibiotics, and they're morbidly obese, and then we eat these products, and of course, we end up suffering the consequences. So, last year, 20,000 Americans died from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. 80% of our antibiotics are being used not to treat sick people, but to treat animals in factory farms, mostly to keep them alive and fat under despicable conditions. And you could say that our factory farms have become breeding grounds for antibiotic-resistant bacteria. You could even say that they have become biological weapons factories that are killing us by the tens of thousands and that threaten the viability of antibiotics for future generations. If you've ever heard of food poisoning, you may realize that half of Americans get food poisoning every year. Most of that comes, again, from the horrible polluted fecal material conditions in our factory farms. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the dreadfully cruel conditions that our food system is creating for these animals, we realize that I think it's an affront to our basic humanity, and I also think that it is a public health hazard that is extremely serious and must be stopped.
Mm-hmm. I was really surprised last week when I was talking with my guest about antibiotic resistance. He was saying how a lot of chicken farmers have moved away from antibiotics and have been successful at it, even though they have not cleaned up their act at all as far as the cleanliness of the factories. It's just that chickens, from the time they're born to when they're killed, they only live about 6 weeks. I had no idea. And so their lifespan is so short that, you know, it's unlikely for the bacteria to really have a chance to really get in there and be so bad. So they've been able to get them off, but they have not transitioned at all off of the antibiotics for the meat and the pork. So
that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, just because the chickens aren't able to die necessarily in 6 weeks, although in Craig's farm 5% did die before they were killed, that doesn't mean they aren't contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria and various pathogens, which is why foodborne illness is such a dreadful concern. 80% of the turkey meat study from Consumer Reports was contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
And if you're just joining us, my guest today is Ocean Robbins. We're talking about his book, The 31-Day Food Revolution, and his organization, Food Revolution Network. So, Ocean, right before the break, I wanted to talk to you about GMOs and the truth about it and the myths that we're being fed, because, you know, so many people think you need GMOs in order to feed the expanding population of the world. And I just know that that's totally not true, and you know that's totally not true, but can you share some light to that for our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, what's a GMO? Some people think it means God move over, But it doesn't. I mean, genetically modified organism. Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, and the other companies in the biotech industry have told us that GMOs would give us better yields, more drought-resistant crops, better flavor and nutrition, and lower use of pesticides. But 25 years into the mass cultivation of GMO crops, we haven't seen any of those benefits. We haven't seen better yields. We haven't seen better nutritional value, lower water consumption, better flavor, and we've seen a net increase of hundreds of millions of pounds of pesticides. What GMOs have brought us is crops that have one or both of two traits, and this is what 99% of what's on the market does. Number one, they are pesticide producers. They literally produce the insecticide BT in every cell of the plant. These crops are literally registered with the EPA as pesticides. They're living pesticide factories. When certain bugs take a bite, their stomachs split open and they die. Now, BT may be okay for humans. It's widely used in organic agriculture today, but it's we've never eaten it in this kind of quantity, and it's not something you can wash off, and there are serious concerns about the amount that we're eating now. Number two is that they are resistant to herbicides, such as glyphosate. And these herbicides are sprayed on the crops, and they kill the weeds, but they don't kill the crops because they've been engineered to resist them. So now we have glyphosate, which is a probable carcinogen, which is an endocrine disruptor, and which is also an antibiotic. It's literally been patented as an antibiotic, so it can kill bacteria, and is now being sprayed on our crops in large quantities. So if you're concerned about GMOs, then the top crops you want to watch out for are corn, soy, canola, sugar beets, which are used to make about half the sugar supply in the United States today, and cotton, which is used for cottonseed oil. And those five crops represent the vast majority. And so if you can eat any of those crops and you want to avoid GMOs and glyphosate, my recommendation is to go organic. You can also go non-GMO certified, which is certainly a good step in the right direction. And there's a lot of good reasons to do that. The biggest concern I have, honestly, about GMOs is the glyphosate, which is the main active ingredient in Roundup. There are more studies coming out all the time linking it to cancer and other health ailments, and like I mentioned, it's an antibiotic. And it's not just used in GMO agriculture, although that's the main use of it. But it's also used as a desiccant now on wheat and oats and other and some legumes. So it's become more important than ever now. If you want to avoid it, go organic, because organically grown foods do not use glyphosate. So particularly with wheat, I think a lot of the allergies and reactions we see to gluten today might actually be tied to the glyphosate being sprayed on the wheat and not necessarily the gluten itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I've thought as well. And yet there's so little money that our government is willing to spend. Really, they're willing to spend no money to actually test these things. I mean, we're still relying on the testing of these products to the chemical companies that developed them.
That's exactly right. It's like, you don't ask a barber if you need a haircut. You know? And these companies have a stake in the game, and so they may conduct multiple studies, and they only publish the ones that are favorable to their commercial interests. And the other studies, they bury them, and no one ever sees them. And this has happened repeatedly. So we don't really know what the impact is of these foods on our health. And even if we knew short-term, we wouldn't know long-term, because we're all like guinea pigs in a mass social experiment. But we do know that in the generation since GMOs came into widespread cultivation and since glyphosate started being sprayed on our crops more and more, we do know that food allergy rates amongst kids have quintupled. 5 times more kids are getting hospitalized right now for food allergies than were a generation ago. And correlation is not causation, but when you see a correlation this strong, it does make you wonder, is it possible that there's a connection?
Absolutely. If you think of us as the guinea pigs, that this has been one big experiment, I think, you know,
that's
just, you know, as you said, really shows the results. And, you know, you don't have to be a scientist to want to really look at it and see that there's a correlation there.
Exactly. Yep.
So another thing you talked about in your book is how to
shop and eat healthy on a budget. The good news is you can do something about it. And as bad as things have gotten, so much better they can be with the change.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said as bad as things have gotten, that's how much better they can be with a change.
Absolutely.
If you're concerned about the status quo, the great news is that something better is possible.
That's true. You know, and trying to make it happen on a larger scale takes everybody really rising up. You know, I talk about that a lot because I feel like there's just so much apathy and people are very busy with their own lives that they don't take that extra step to, you know, go out to a rally or to write a letter to their congressman or whatever it might take to show a swell of public outcry. And we really need to show us that swell of public outcry. You know, I talked about, you know, my guest last week talked about the Netherlands and Denmark, you know, how they've reduced the use of antibiotics so much in their factory farms, and that was because of the outcry of their public. And, you know, and the reduction in chicken farms came from the outcry of public. And so we have to really realize that there is power in people power, and the lobbyists have just so much power that in order to combat that and to make the politicians listen to us as opposed to the lobbyists, we need to really get loud.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do.
We need to get loud, and we need to get serious, and we need to go deep and be purposeful and intentional. You know, the beautiful thing is that we don't have to wait for Monsanto or McDonald's or the U.S. government to be able to take charge of our health. You know, the system is corrupt and sick and sickening. But we don't have to participate. We can actually build a new economy. We get to redirect our dollars and build a healthier food system with our knives and forks. And so I like to say that every dollar you spend and every bite you take is a vote. You're voting for the health you want, and you're voting for the world you want. And so let's make it a conscious one. Let's make it a beautiful one. Let's decide to vote every day for a better, brighter, more beautiful future.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about how we can make organic foods more available to some of the more disadvantaged people who don't have access to healthy food. And I know you do talk about that in your book and in your lectures. So maybe you can share some insight with us on that.
Sure. So first of all, let's talk about the systemic problem. In the United States, and throughout the developed world, we have government subsidies that go towards more of the same. Tens of billions of dollars a year in taxpayer money subsidize what we call commodities crops. We are essentially bringing down the price of things like factory-farmed meat, Wonder Bread, Twinkies, and high-fructose corn syrup. Twinkies has 14 subsidized ingredients. The entire factory farming system is built on subsidized corn and soy and other commodities crops. Coca-Cola doesn't use high fructose corn syrup in Europe. Why? Because it's not subsidized. In the United States, they say they couldn't afford not to. Why? Because it is subsidized, because it's based on corn. Now, why are we not subsidizing broccoli, kale, vegetables, cabbage? Why aren't we subsidizing the whole foods and the vegetables and the nuts and seeds that we know, based on every study we have available to us, are beneficial for human health? It's insane. And it's sickening us because you know who's impacted the most is the poor folks. The poorer you are statistically, the more likely you are to base more of your calories on the foods that are subsidized by taxpayer money. And that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are essentially condemning the poorest sectors of our society to nutritional disasters by taking taxpayer money and putting it into the foods that they're then going to become dependent on. It's like, you know, water goes downhill and we make the path of least resistance, in the path of lowest cost, the path of worst health. What kind of sense does that make? It's cruel, and it's inhumane, and it's insane. So I'm saying if we're going to subsidize anything, let's subsidize healthy foods for low-income communities. And there are some signs of hope. For example, the SNAP program, the food stamp program, Wholesome Wave is a nonprofit program that is partnering with the USDA, and they double the value of food stamps when they're used to purchase fruits and vegetables. And for the 500,000 Americans who are in this program, guess what? They're eating more fruits and vegetables. They're buying more, and they're eating more, and they're going to be healthier because of it. And that's just one example. So systemically, we can make big changes. We could also change the way that organic certification works. Right now, if you want to grow food and you're a farmer, and you decide you want to grow organically and be certified, you have to pay extra to be certified, thousands of dollars, for a regulatory burden to have someone come and say that you're doing it right. What if we flipped that? What if the people who are using the poisons had to pay the regulatory burden, and the organic farmers had less regulations? Because after all, what they're doing is safer. What we have right now is like you're being fined for wearing your seatbelt. And what if we flip that around? Put the regulatory burden on the pesticide and poison users, and suddenly the price would flip, and organic would probably be cheaper. Amazing. It would happen that fast. So those are a few policy things. But let's talk about you and me, because we can't necessarily change Washington policy overnight. We will in time, but not overnight. So for right now, what do we do if we want to eat healthy? Well, and we want to do it on a budget. We don't have the ability to spend our whole paycheck on whole foods. So first of all, the most expensive calories you will ever consume are the ones that make you sick. Last time I checked, cancer was pretty expensive. So was Alzheimer's. So when you choose to avoid the foods that make you sick, you can save a lot of money in the long run. In the shorter run, the next most expensive calories are the ones you waste. The average American wastes over $2,000 a year on food that simply goes bad because we don't eat it in time. So when you shop from a list, when you plan ahead, when you avoid impulse purchases, you can be more intentional about it, and you can make friends with leftovers, and you can avoid that waste, which will save you in time some serious cash. The next most expensive calories are the ones you didn't need. They fatten you up. The average American gets more than 500 calories too much. What we find is that when we are nutrient-starved because we're filling up on hyper-processed junk foods, then we're chronically hungry because we're not getting certain critical nutrient needs met. So when you eat enough fiber, for example, it actually sends a signal to your belly that you're full. And when you don't get enough fiber, it doesn't. Less than 3% of the U.S. population gets enough fiber. No wonder so many of us are chronically feeling hungry, because we're not getting the fiber and the other critical nutrients that we need in order to feel satisfied at a cellular level. So I'm saying when you eat less processed junk, you'll be less addicted, and you'll be more nourished, and you won't overeat. And cutting out those 500 calories a day can save serious money as well.
What are the best sources of fiber out there?
So here's the thing. There is no fiber in any animal products of any kind. Zero. There is no fiber in bottled oils, and there is very little in white flour or in sugar. So when you cut out or cut down on those things, you make room for the good stuff. The best sources of fiber are going to be legumes, vegetables, whole plant foods, essentially. They all have fiber. Now, certain foods have particularly special kinds of fiber that are good for your digestive tract, especially jicama, Jerusalem artichokes, asparagus, onions, garlic. There are many different kinds of fiber, and these foods that I'm naming in particular are great for your microbiome. They feed the good guys in your digestion. But all kinds of fiber help clean you out, help keep you regular, help your body to keep moving in good ways. And, you know, considering that less than 3% of Americans get the recommended daily amount, it's probably the single nutrient that most of us are deficient in today.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful, I think. And what gives you hope in the world of food?
In the last generation, we've seen a fivefold increase in the number of farmers markets. We've seen a fivefold increase in the number of community-supported agriculture programs in the United States. We have seen a 20% drop in sales of sugary breakfast cereals. We are seeing more and more people interested in natural foods. Organic food sales are skyrocketing. People are sick of being sick and tired of being tired and fed up with toxic food system, and more of us are hungry for a change, and we are participating in that change. So what gives me hope is all the people of all ages and colors and backgrounds who are saying enough is enough. It's time to make a change. It's time to make a difference. It's time to build a healthier world. And so I think there's a food revolution building, and I think we all get to be a part of it. And more of us.
I agree with you. I mean, I've been, you know, eating a mostly plant-based diet for so many years, and I have seen it grow a lot. I mean, you used to not be able to go into a regular supermarket and get anything organic. Or what was organic was all wilted and looked horrible. And now you can really, you know, there's an organic section in every supermarket.
Yeah, exactly. When I was a kid, you couldn't find soy milk in any mainstream grocery store. Now it's not just soy. There's almond and hemp and rice and flax and, you know, pea and all sorts of different kinds of alternative milks. That's just one example of the radical change, you know, that has taken place. When I was a kid, you couldn't find tofu in Safeway. Now it's not just tofu. There's hemp foo, and, you know, like, people are trying all kinds of new stuff. And, you know, it's exciting to see the innovation and creativity that's going into making healthy
food. What do you think about the expansion of the meat substitute products? I mean, some of them I think are good, some of them I think are not so good. What's your opinion on
that? Yeah, I mean, if Beyond Burgers and Impossible Burgers, I mean, I'm excited that from an environmental standpoint and from an ethical standpoint, they're more sustainable and they're certainly less cruel than factory-farmed meat products. From a health standpoint, it's arguable. It depends on what you're eating. But ultimately, we're talking about hyper-processed foods. They come from factories. They're not really what our bodies were designed for. So, you know, is it better than a steak or, you know, a meat burger? Possibly, maybe even probably. But, you know, the Impossible Burger has, I think, as much saturated fat as a hamburger.
And it's made with GMOs.
And it's made with GMOs, and it's hyper-processed. So at that point, is it really better for you? Maybe not. I mean, we don't have studies on that. I appreciate that it's opening people's minds and I think it's a transition for a lot of people. The fact that Burger King and, you know, Carl's Jr. are selling these things, I think, is a helpful step towards creating a wedge in the public consciousness that it's possible to move away from dependency on animal products and not have your taste buds suffer. But ultimately, I think it's just a step. And if we stop there, we're not going to benefit very much.
Right, right. Another thing you write about that I love, because I talk about it quite a bit too, is gratitude. I mean, gratitude's not something you can really teach someone, and yet you can help to cultivate it. And gratitude, you know, makes us all more thankful and happier. Can you talk a little bit about the neuroscience that you talk about in your book when it comes to gratitude?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I used to think that there are a lot of studies showing that people who express more gratitude are healthier and happier. But I used to think that was because they had more things to be grateful for. I figured that, of course, if things go well, you're going to be grateful, right? And then, of course, you're going to be happier. But it turns out, you could think of this as a chicken or egg kind of situation. It turns out that sometimes when people express gratitude, things actually get better in the world around them. And this is a fascinating thing. So there are studies showing that when people take time at the end of the day to write down three things they're grateful for, compared to other people who do not, they're going to exercise more. They're going to eat better, statistically. They're going to have healthier marriages. They're less likely to end up on antidepressants. They are more likely to be satisfied with their lives. And these are two groups of people, each of them were the same at the outset. So it's not like we took people that were already happy and healthy and had them write down things they're grateful for. We took equal groups, and the ones who wrote it down became healthier and happier over time. So this shows that gratitude isn't just a thing that happens to you. It actually can become a verb. It can be something you create and express and live. So we all have things to be grateful for, and we focus so much in the modern world on what's wrong, what's broken. And you know, sometimes a squeaky wheel gets the grease, and we need to fix the broken stuff for sure. But let's remember to also give thanks for what works, for the fact that you have breath in your lungs and blood in your veins and love in your heart and people that you care about and whatever it is that you're grateful for. When you notice that, when you experience that, I think that what you appreciate appreciates. What you bring your consciousness to does indeed expand. So I say let's use that principle and that tool to create more joy and satisfaction and fulfillment. The simple act of saying grace around a meal when a family sits together and go around the circle and everyone says something they're grateful for, it brings the family together. It builds harmony and connection, and it actually helps you digest your food better. Because taking that time to put your body into a state of receptivity and relaxation actually helps you to salivate more. It helps your stomach to digest better. It puts you not in a fight or flight reactive response to life, but rather in a nourishment receptive state. And so I think that how we eat matters a lot, not just what we eat. And when you take the time to give thanks, to savor your food, to smell it, to think about the farmers and farm workers who brought it to you, then there is something that happens in your metabolism that enables you to receive more benefit and more nourishment from it.
That's so beautiful, and I truly believe it's true as well. And I have to say, I am really grateful that you are here with your book and sharing your knowledge and your love with so many people and really spreading this message, because it's one that, you know, needs to be out there. And I've heard so many people speak and talk about changing their diet, and I have to say that the way you do it, you really resonate with love and compassion, and it's just beautiful. Another thing I want to share is I know that you have pledged with your book, for every copy of your book that you sell, you actually donate to Trees for the Future, which I think is another really beautiful thing, planting a tree in a low-income community. So I really salute you for that. And we are almost out of time, and I thought maybe you could just share with everybody before we sign off your website and how they can get your book. And I don't know if you're going to be in the New York area at all speaking. You might want to share that as well. Or anywhere, actually.
Thank you so much.
Any event coming up.
You can grab a copy of 31 Day Food Revolution anywhere books are sold. You can also go grab it at 31dayfoodrevolution.com. Again, that's the number 31dayfoodrevolution.com. And you can join the food revolution. We have a website with 20,000 visitors every day learning about healthy food. Go to foodrevolution.org to find out more and to join in our email list. And, you know, remember, you are part of the food revolution every time you choose real food over processed junk, every time you choose to buy from a local farmer, every time you choose to prepare food with love, every time you choose to share healthy food with someone you care about. So we are building a revolution that is changing the course of history, and we're doing it together. And I just want to thank you for your partnership in spreading this message and living this message. And I'm just so grateful that we all get to be a part of something beautiful that matters. You know, there are so many problems in the world that can feel overwhelming and unconfrontable. But when it comes to food, we really have immense power to author our lives in a beautiful way and write a new chapter that's more beautiful and more health-giving and more life-affirming than the last. And that fills me with joy.
Amen. Yeah, thank you so much, Ocean. Really, really beautiful. I love your book, and I will share this with all of my listeners. So thank you so much for joining me. Everyone out there who's joined us today, thank you so much, and have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.